Sie werden jetzt ein paar Songs aus einer Oper für Bettler hören. Weil diese Oper so prunkvoll gedacht war, wie nur Bettler sie erträumen, und weil sie doch so billig sein sollte, dass Bettler sie bezahlen können, heißt sie die Drei-Groschen-Oper.
Okay, hallo.
Hallo.
Guten Abend, meine Herren und Damen.
Yes, okay. So, welcome to a modified version of Rediscovering German Futurist Cinema. We're going to begin with the first three minutes of Orson Welles' F is for Fake, apropos of nothing and everything.
For my next experiment, ladies and gentlemen, I would appreciate the loan of any small personal object from your pocket. A key, a box of matches, a coin.
Here it is. Good, sir. Hold it up. 10 feet over your head.
For my next experiment.
Watch out for the slightest.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
I would appreciate the loan of any small personal object from your pocket. Experiment. Key, a box of matches, a coin. I would appreciate the loan of any small personal object from your pocket.
10 feet.
A
your
key,
head.
A box of
watch your coin, the slightest of the key.
It
is.
It's been returned to you.
Thank you, thank you.
Grocery store.
10 feet over your head. Key. Watch out, the slightest of the
transfer. May we see it, please?
Thank you, Jane.
Behold your key
before our very eyes.
After your old tricks, I see.
Why not? Transformation.
What happened to you, Jane?
It's been returned.
What's that, sir? Did I used to be a magician, sir? I'm still working on it.
The key. Into a coin.
As for the key,
what happened to you?
It was not.
May we see it, please?
Symbolic of anything.
You'll find the key.
You'll find the coin now in your pocket,
why not?
Sir.
May we see it, please?
A charlatan coin. What's that, sir? Did I used to be a magician, sir? I'm still working.
Why not?
As for the key,
return
a charlatan. It was not.
What's
that, sir? Did I used to be a magician, sir? I'm still working.
That kind of already returned.
As for the key,
coin now in your pocket.
It was not.
Have you ever heard of
symbolic events?
Speaking of magicians,
I
coin.
But of course you do know my father.
Mother, is this right?
Houdin was the greatest magician who ever lived. Do you know what he said?
Return you to your mother. Is this your mother?
Have you ever heard of
Robert Houdin?
Speaking of magicians,
I mean.
But of course, you do know my pride.
Just an actor.
Speaking of magicians,
I do.
But of course, you do know my partner, François Reichenbach.
Hello.
Houdin was the greatest magician who ever lived. Do you know what he said?
Very nice.
And he's just fabulous.
Just an actor.
Well, good luck.
Good story, though.
Just an actor.
Want to tell it?
Playing the part of a magician, he said.
Now it's time for an introduction to him.
Well, good luck.
Just an actor.
Playing the part of a magician.
No.
very nice.
And she's fabulous.
Ladies and gentlemen, by way of introduction, this is a film about trickery.
Very nice.
And she's
now it's time for an introduction.
About
good story.
Tell it.
Now it's time for an introduction.
Almost any stories. Ladies and gentlemen, by way of introduction, this is a film about trickery.
Not this time. This is a promise.
Ladies and gentlemen, during the next election,
everything you hear from us is really true.
Based on solid facts.
In a movie.
Don't talk about Napoleon or Julius Caesar. You're talking about
Elmire.
Elmire?
Who is Elmire?
That question has yet to be answered with any real precision.
Yes, can we have the house lights up? Okay. Okay, so thank you for coming. I had planned to do a very elaborate and complicated presentation, and I'm not able to do that. However, I do have the materials to show you. So I'll try and give you a brief, very truncated version of our backstory. The situation is this. I began studying German cinema of the 1920s a few years ago, just out of my love for these films. And I I discovered that the cultural environment at the time is extremely complicated. And these films that we know, films like Metropolis by Fritz Lang or Nosferatu by F.W. Murnau, these films were hugely commercially successful in their time. However, these directors were not simply Hollywood hacks or something like this. These were people that were trained in fine art. Fritz Lang as a painter, F.W. Murnau with an advanced degree in art history. And in spite of making very unusual and very interesting films that were commercially successful in their day, they were looking for other outlets. And their environment was an environment in which these avant-garde ideas were very much prevalent. For example, the members of the Berlin Dada movement were employees of UFA, which was the Berlin studios that produced these films. So these were associates of Lang, Murnau, G.W. Pabst. And I also discovered that there was some experimental work made by these directors that did not receive commercial distribution. Murnau, Lang, and Pabst worked with a cinematographer named Eugen Schifftan. And Schifftan shot many of their films and also did special effects on many of the films. So when you watch Metropolis and you see these scenes of multiple layers of video superimposed over each other, this is Eugen Schifftan. He worked in Germany until 1933, emigrated to the U.S. and worked in Hollywood until the 70s. But his early experimental work with these directors languished in an archive in Germany, in the F.W. Murnau archive. And I received some clues about this material that was in the archive and slowly uncovered bits of this material. Initially, first, a single still. Let me show you the still image. It was clearly something that came from Metropolis, but it was not a still image from Metropolis. So, give me one moment. It was clearly a manipulation of the original source material of Metropolis. So, I'm sorry. Okay. After discovering these still images, I discovered that these still images were actually taken from experimental films that were derived from the commercial works that Lang, Murnau, and Pabst had made. So give me one moment, please. Okay, here's the first film that I discovered by Eugen Schifftan.
Could we have the house lights down? The title means dynamism or study of rhythm, study of rhythm movement, and I believe that maybe it's a reference to Marcel Duchamp's New Descending a Staircase. This was the second discovery. I noticed that these images were originally taken from G.W. Pabst, Pandora's Box, which Schifftan had acted as cinematographer on. So my theory is that he was working on materials that he had shot himself. So how is it possible that these experimental films were made in 1927? Well, Eugen Schifftan was something of an inventor, and in 1924 he received a patent on something called the Schifftan process, which is used by Hollywood today to superimpose images over each other. For example, in Metropolis with this scene, part of it was shot as live action and part of it was a set. The Schifftan process allows these two images to be melded together. This is a diagram from the patent for the Schifftan process. At this point, I'm going to play two longer films made by Eugen Schifftan in 1927. These two films are derived from G.W. Pabst's Pandora's Box. The first is entitled The Death of Dr. Schön, and the second is entitled The Death of Lulu. These are the two main characters of the film. Each is 8 minutes.
Je me souviens de ce temps d'autrefois où nous vivions tous les deux, elle et moi, et de mon mieux, moi je la soupçonnais, elle en revanche, fort bien m'entretenait. Ainsi les choses gentiment se passaient. Quand un galant venait, je lui cédais le lit. Et puis au vin m'enfuis sans donner grand bruit. Je leur tends eau, fromage, pain et fruits. Et s'ils payent bien, je leur dis, venez ça, retournez-y quand vous serez en lui. Oh, ce bourdel, où tenons notre état. Thank you.
Seiner Frau Polly, angeblich um vor seinen Feinden zu fliehen, in Wirklichkeit aber, um sich seinem alten Lotterleben wieder in die Arme zu werfen.
Ach, Mac, reiß mir doch nicht das Herz aus dem Leibe. Bleibe bei mir und lass uns glücklich sein.
Ich muss mir ja selber das Herz aus dem Leibe reißen, denn ich muss fort und niemand weiß, wann ich wiederkehre.
Es hat so kurz gedauert, Mac.
Hört es denn auf?
Ach, gestern, da hatte ich einen Traum. Da sah ich aus dem Fenster, denn ich hörte ein Gelächter in der Gasse. Und wie ich dann hinaufsah, da sah ich unseren Mond. Und der Mond war ganz dünn, wie ein Penny, der schon abgegriffen ist. Vergiss mich nicht, Mac, in den fremden Städten.
Sicher vergess ich dich nicht, Polly. Küss mich, Polly.
Adieu, Mac.
Adieu, Polly.
Mackies verabschiedet sich von seiner Frau Polly, angeblich um vor seinen Feinden zu fliehen, in Wirklichkeit aber, um sich seinem alten Lotterleben wieder in die Arme zu werfen.
Ach Mac, reiß mir doch nicht das Herz aus dem Leibe. Bleibe bei mir und lass uns glücklich sein.
Ich muss mir ja selber das Herz aus dem Leibe reißen, denn ich muss fort und niemand weiß, wann ich wiederkehre.
Es hat so kurz gedauert, Mac.
Hört es denn auf?
Ach, gestern, da hatte ich einen Traum. Da sah ich aus dem Fenster, denn ich hörte ein Gelächter in der Gasse. Und wie ich dann hinaufsah, da sah ich unseren Mond. Und der Mond war ganz dünn, wie ein Penny, der schon abgegriffen ist. Vergiss mich nicht, Mac, in den fremden Städten.
Sicher vergess ich dich nicht, Polly. Küss mich, Polly.
Adieu, Mac.
Adieu, Polly.
Okay, I'm going to speak, I'm Miriam Atkin, and I'm going to speak to you tonight about the little-known futurist movement in early 20th century German cinema. These recently discovered films that you've just seen prove that such a movement happened. With the grisly repercussions of the pairing of machine and politics well known to us in the 21st century, with the grisly repercussions of the pairing of machine and politics well known to us in the 21st century, we can now read Marinetti's "We" as a pronouncement of the fascistic bullying power that any cult of technology would have unavoidably claimed for itself 100 years ago. Furthermore, the ideological drive to laud beautiful ideas which kill, a proposed aim of futurist art as per Marinetti's 1909 manifesto, is doubly, abominably significant when considered alongside the Nazi doctrine of Aryan beauty. This drive, specifically in its German expression, perhaps can be seen to have culminated, for all practical purposes, in a total defeat of beauty's victims. If the inevitable rise of Nazism was a conscious or unconscious topic in the films which this lecture aims to prove attributable to a movement called German Futurism, Marinetti's battle cry rings particularly ominous to our retrospective understanding of that movement. And, if we are to examine Futurism in light of its explicit fascism, we must consider the paradox that is built into its ideological program. If art is in the violent, frenetic movements of warfare, in the roaring motor car which seems to run on machine gun fire, then when the battle is won, art dies. If such an art were to truly believe in itself, it would be compelled to treat its enemy with the care befitting an intimate friend. Thus, to our consciences conditioned to imagine that evil has an Aryan face, The German incarnation of that aesthetic attitude occurs as the memory of a massacre that won't stop killing. Perhaps, then, the art in question cannot properly be called a movement, as it does not wish for its own victorious fulfillment and subsequent widespread implementation as political aesthetic program, but rather depends upon the strength of its opposition in order to maintain the hostile conditions necessary for its sustained action. And it is, in a sense, still sustaining itself, as history has failed to produce new monsters and victims. Leaving us its images as monument to the birth of our current angel of death, German futurism was an effort, both suicidal and homicidal, that hoped to infinitely delay its own success, the drive toward death for which death would prove a disappointment, insomnia as political project. And now, a century later, as the next logical development of that drive, and after bearing witness to an ongoing grandiose technological massacre of the familiar, art strives to maintain an intimacy with death so that it may hear the angel speak its opinion on life. And so, if we were to develop the technology to measure the progress of the somnambulist's journey by tracking the space between each step, with the step conceived as our basic spatio-temporal unit, and then assessing the provable features of reality accumulated amid our subject, the achievement of an agreed-upon distance, we could decode the gestural vocabulary of the Caligarian Docido and make death speak to life as I speak to you today. Is the sleepwalker awake all night with Marinetti and his friend plotting attack on the vulnerable somnolent peons? The sluggish old men, the idle women, the earth-bound farmers, our native sloth, with youthful zeal for an art that puts sleep to sleep and puts death to death. And can we know in the end on whose side is this coterie of demented dreamers, the side of nocturnal reverie, cool and aqueous under the light, depthful current of Marinetti's enemy stars encamped in their celestial bivouacs, or the side of desire raging in midnight stoke holes and belching black emissions over dirty flophouse beds, to know what entail a certain stepping out for a better vantage point, a quitting of the world to inquire after death's opinion on life, a calculated mise-en-scene of unconscious inclination in the clearing just beyond the brush. Such a movement is illustrated in this final scene from F.W. Murnau's 1922 film, At Long Last. What we see here is the protagonist, Drew Capilonis, private detective, in the foreground, losing composure at the unexpected appearance of Dave Helmet, secret agent without a face. The film is an account of Capilonis' pursuit of his nemesis Helmet, an icy killer whom he has nicknamed David Death. The plot narrates a mutually dependent love-hate relationship spanning multiple decades in which the two are caught. From the beginning, we have a sense of Capilonis's ongoing seduction by the very forces of darkness which he, as private detective, is employed hopelessly to ferret out and harness. The climax pictured behind me has the two enemies meeting at last, which incites the jarring disintegration of the character of Capellanus as we have known it thus far, since the film has identified him from the start in terms of the consistent, frustrating distance between himself and his objective. Here he sits in his dark private eye apartment, a cat pawing its battered dish in the corner, wine glasses collecting dust on the kitchen shelves. The bare hanging bulb that dimly lights his place from behind only serves to remind him of how conspicuous is his loneliness as the reason for his wholehearted but fundamentally empty fidelity to the pursuit of a faceless adversary. Like the cat, he fingers a plate on the table before him, crusted with yesterday's dinner. He sees himself as if from far away. Then David Death makes his entrance, standing in the doorway, frozen, his big round head looking. Capellanus turns and sees. The lonely image of himself at the table vanishes from his mind. The bulb flickers out, and in an instant he loses his head. His perspective, his vision, and cognition all collapsed into the unitary and unprecedented emotion that this moment of moments has prompted. Is it that the clunky perfs and sprockets, nuts, bolts, gears, wheels, warp and weft of the brain toward death combusting over the kitchen table breakfast nook are, without the intervention of mechanics or politicians, so naturally good at what they do, silently, modestly, seamlessly tectonic, that they appear to us as white and spiritual as the windy robes of ghosts? Is it the case that our faces are recognizable as our own only because, while voluntary muscular control of the orbicularis oculi works to sculpt the brow, we deliberately rouse the zygomaticus to invite its own unique curvature, its signature smile? Do we wake up each day and, without knowing it, willfully decide to flex our facial muscles in such a way that allows us to yet resemble ourselves? I see you, David. I see your shape in heavy outline, hovering in my doorway like you had 12 wings, your globose head looking at me as though full of eyes. You are clumsily tridimensional as you emerge from the gossamer light that beckons me now. Let me rise and come to meet you. The private detective slowly crosses the room, shedding bits of energy and subatomic particles at such a rate that, unbeknownst to him, he is already just a ghost once he reaches his destination. Dave Helmet retreats a few steps, making way for the hot churning mass and watching it billow from the apartment. The outer wall of Drew Capellanus' residence is black. It is a sturdy, old-fashioned kind of wall that reveals nothing of the pathetic history it has housed. The cigarettes, the late nights at the window, crackling broadcast jazz tunes and women in picture frames. The image behind me shows that wall and the narrow door at its center, open wide with Capellanus' swirling light matter issuing from it. At this point, we can only speculate as to whether or not there is a room inside. But we have a sense of the wild, uncontained intention behind that wall, seeking the space ahead of it, heaving and surging into whatever it finds. It is something infinitely big and growing, like flood tides moving over city blocks, washing away people in their cars and filling the gaps between buildings, filling up everything, rising higher and spreading out wide under the sun's capacious rays, so that there are no longer any objects and the city is just a soothing sort of rushing noise under full spectrum lighting. With the grisly repercussions of the pairing of machine and politics well known to us in the 21st century, we can now read Marinetti's "We" as a pronouncement of the fascistic bullying power that any cult of technology would have unavoidably claimed for itself 100 years ago.
Thank you.
My next experiment, ladies and gentlemen, I would appreciate the loan of any small personal object from your pocket. A key, a box of matches, a coin.
Here it is. Good, sir. Hold it up 10 feet over your head and watch out for the slightest hint of hanky-panky. And behold, before our very eyes, a transformation. We've changed your key into a coin. What happened to the key? It's been returned to you. Look closely, sir. You'll find the key back in your pocket. May we see it, please?
After your old tricks, I see.
Why not? I'm a charlatan. What's that, sir? Did I used to be a magician? Sir, I'm still working on it. As for the key, it was not symbolic of anything.
This isn't that kind of movie. You'll find the coin now in your pocket, sir.
Keep your eyes on that coin, sir, while it's returned to you as your key.
Shall we return you to your mother? Is this your mother? No, of course not. Open your mouth wide, and we'll return you your money. By the way, have you ever heard of Robert Houdin? Speaking of magicians, I mean.
No, of course not. But of course you do know my partner, Francois Reichenbach.
Hello.
Houdin was the greatest magician who ever lived. And do you know what he said?
A magician, he said, is just an actor.
Well, good luck to you.
Just an actor, playing the part of a magician.
Very nice.
And she's fabulously rich, too. It's a good story about it.
Do you want to tell it?
We'll come to that one later. Now it's time for an introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, by way of introduction, this is a film about trickery and fraud, about lies. Tell it by the fireside or in a marketplace or in a movie. Almost any story is almost certainly some kind of lie. But not this time. No, this is a promise. During the next hour, everything you'll hear from us is really true and based on solid facts.
Thank you. His grandfather was Hungarian, did he? Paint any pictures?
Never in his life.
Ladies and gentlemen, we did use Oya's grandfather to lend verisimilitude to the reenactment of this story. But is reenactment really the word? What I mean is, with a story this hard to believe, reenactment isn't easy. Right, Francois? Right. At the very... Is reenactment really the word? What I mean is, with a story this hard to believe, reenactment isn't easy. Right, Francois? Right. At the very beginning of all this, I did make you a promise. Remember?
I did promise that for 1 hour, I'd tell you only the truth.
That hour, ladies and gentlemen, is over. For the past 17 minutes, I've been lying my head off.
The truth, and please forgive us for it, is that we've been forging an art story.
As a charlatan, of course, my job was to try to make it real. Not that reality has anything to do with it.
Reality? It's the toothbrush waiting at home for you in its glass. A bus ticket, a paycheck, and the grave.
In the right mood, perhaps Elmire has just as few regrets as I have to have been a charlatan. But we're not so proud, either of us, as to lay any superior claim to being very much worse than the rest of you.
we professional liars hope to serve is truth. I'm afraid the pompous word for that is art. Picasso himself said it. Art, he said, is a lie. A lie that makes us realize the truth. Hoyer's grandfather, floating here in the air, has no comment, which isn't surprising because he never existed.
To the memory of that great man who will never cease to exist, I offer my apologies. And wish you all, true and false, a very pleasant good evening.
Okay, thank you. Good night. So a special thank you to Apple Keynote.